listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. Welcome,
hi,
all of you. Welcome to you, Greg.
Howdy.
Here's a question from Bird.
Bird?
Bird.
Like B-I-R-D?
Yes, like B-I-R-D.
All right, just okay.
What's a winsome approach to someone who defends abortion by arguing an unwanted pregnancy may cause great suffering and or lead to suicide? While killing is always immoral, compassion for the mother oftentimes stops our arguments from convincing many people.
Well, in this situation, let me back up for a second. I was going to say one thing. I want to start out differently. I understand the appeal to compassion. Unfortunately, this is part of the problem. The problem is, in order to be allegedly compassionate to one person, we do something terribly evil to another person. But it seems like it ain't so bad because we have good motives, and that is to be compassionate to the mother. Okay? So I'm just wondering, if I were to face this and I wanted to use a tactical approach and I wanted to kind of strip this away layer by layer, what questions would I use? And I'd say, you know, I think being compassionate is really important. But how far does our commitment to compassion go? Can we do anything in virtue of compassion to one person? So let's just say I'm talking to somebody and I say, there is a person who's homeless, doesn't have any place to stay, doesn't even have a car to sleep in. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take your car and give it to him because I'm being compassionate to that person so he would have some place to sleep in. Is that okay? Because I'm being compassionate. So there's a counterexample. Now, I think sometimes when I raise counterexamples like this, people can see what I'm going to try to do, and so they rattle on and run right by it. In other words, they don't address it. Well, that's not the same thing. I'm talking about something different. That's where you need to gently pull them back. All I want to do is just answer this simple question. Do you think it's okay for me to take your car and give it to somebody else because I feel compassion to them? That's a simple question. Yes or no? Well, I'm sure they're going to say no. All right. So, okay. Well, then, okay. Then why is it okay for me to take somebody's life to be compassionate to another person? It's a fair question, because I think that's what's going on here. And what happens, and this is what troubles me and why I paused at the beginning, because this compassion approach is difficult, because if you disagree with the person who is making the compassion appeal, then you are considered the non-compassionate person. Okay, and that's awful. You're not compassionate. Wait a minute. I'm the one who is trying to protect the life of the innocent human being that you are suggesting ought to be sacrificed to make somebody else's life more livable. Even if the characterization there was completely accurate, that their life will be more livable and they'd be much happier. Is that a justifiable reason to kill somebody? By the way, this is what criminals do. Criminals take what isn't their own to make their lives easier and more satisfying. But we draw the line there. They're called criminals because what they take is not theirs to take, even though it improves their lives. So the difficulty in answering this question, now those who are listening just heard me walk through there and you're going, oh, well, that makes sense. But you usually can't get through that, because the minute you start making the moral case the way I've done, people are going to charge you, maybe even silently in their heart, with being the non-compassionate person, and I'm just going to shrug you off. See, you pro-lifers, you don't really care. Look at this woman. Look at this woman. Look at what she's going to have to endure. All right? And so you don't, they are not willing to face the moral arithmetic, which is the thing that actually determines what is the proper compassionate thing to do. I mean, I can think of a really extreme case, all right? You're in a Nazi concentration camp, and here's a Jewish woman that's serving food for the commandant. She's from the camp, but she's serving. She's pressed into service in the household of the commandant. All right, you want to free that woman? Who is going to serve the food for the commandant? You're not being compassionate to the commandant. Now, this is a grotesquely extreme example, but sometimes you have to use a grotesquely extreme example in order to get people's attention. Okay? No one would say you shouldn't liberate this woman because it's not compassionate to the commandant who loses a servant or slave labor, essentially. No one would say that. But there is a benefit that the commandant gets that he would have to sacrifice. All right? But obviously the weight morally is so much more on one side. Okay, so now here's what we're looking at. We're not talking about a prison camp intern being freed. We are talking about a child's life being saved. Isn't that even more extreme? We're talking about we're going to kill the child so mom isn't inconvenienced or maybe get really depressed and get suicidal. Well, look at if you just want to do simple math on this, if she carries to term and then gets suicidal and kills herself, then you still have, in the total equation, one dead person. Terrible. Don't want it. But don't you see that there's a difference between a woman killing herself and the woman killing the baby? And the killing the baby is guaranteed in abortion. The woman killing herself is not guaranteed. To be honest, most women respond really well to having a child because it's their child. The point I'm making here is you can't just assert that everything's going to be miserable for a woman who goes through an unwanted pregnancy. That's what's commonly asserted, but you can't just assume that. In most cases, I don't think it's like that. All right? Both of our daughters are adopted from surprise pregnancies. All right? And both of them had birth mothers who went through a lot of pain to give the baby up because of their emotional attachment to their own child. Now, they could have avoided by having an abortion early on. That wouldn't have been without consequence, by the way, emotionally. But even so, it would have been, in some senses, one might think, easier because they are not taking a child that they've given birth to and given away. That's harder, probably. Or at least that's the way people will put it. But even so, yes, it's hard, but that's a pain they endure rather than killing their own child. And even if they carry to term and keep the child, the burdens that are there, they may be burdensome, but does that justify proactively killing the child so you might not have bad feelings? This is how people's thinking on this, Amy, morally speaking, is so twisted. It is just so twisted. My wife worked for many years in a CPC, Crisis Pregnancy Center, and that's where I met her, actually, when she was working there, and I did an event for them. And she encountered woman after woman that was pregnant that wanted to get an abortion, and she said, why don't you carry to term and give the baby away to someone who wants the baby? And what they said is, I couldn't possibly give my baby away. So you're going to kill the baby now. That's the equation. I couldn't give my baby away, they mean emotionally, so I'm going to kill the baby now. Do you see? This is how twisted people's thinking has gotten on it. And that's the so-called compassion defense for abortion. So I think what I've done is cash this out in a very clear way. Of course, I'm presuming that the unborn is a full human being, which is scientifically true. And I've cashed it out in a very clear way, but do not count on cashing it out in this clear way and having the person you're talking with not dismiss you as an insensitive, of unloving, non-compassionate person because you don't want to let a mother kill her own baby to make her life easier. People's thinking is very twisted on this issue.
And I think the reason why people become so confused as soon as we start talking about this topic comes back to what we always say about when you're discussing the pro-life view, and that is, what is the unborn? because nobody would say, I should have a right to kill this woman's child, or this woman should have a right to kill her 2-year-old or her 3-year-old because the 3-year-old's making her feel suicidal. Nobody would say that. And the reason why is because mm-hmm. they're clear on the fact that this is a human being. But as soon as we're talking about the unborn and that becomes unclear, you start getting all of these strange ideas like the one you just mentioned, Greg. I would rather my child be dead mm-hmm. than be with someone else. As if that's indicating their love for the child. It doesn't make sense. But part of it is they aren't seeing unborn as a human being who's already in existence, who's already alive, who's already their child. So ultimately, that's going to have to be addressed. But of course, if you're answering this question, the way you answer is going to depend on who's asking you. Is the person actually pregnant and feeling suicidal? Well, probably a reasoned response like this isn't going to be where you're going to start, because there's a lot of emotion involved. As you said, Greg, it's going to be hard to get to the reasoning. And in that case, you do have to begin with saying, just assuring them, yes, I think the woman is important. I don't want anyone to feel suicidal. I'm here for you. I can help you. But let's think about what exactly it is that you want to do. What does it mean to have an abortion? What are you doing? What is that inside of you? And Greg, I thought your examples were so clear and so good. If anyone can get to that point where they can make that argument, I just think that argument is so good. But you're going to have to address the question of what the unborn is, or none of this will make sense to people.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said something that I want to draw attention to. It's a great response here, Amy. But you said that it's beholden upon us that we are sensitive to the emotional concerns and the needs of the mother. Okay, we get it. We understand that. Okay, here's what came to me then. This is, by the way, this is characteristic of pro-lifers. Although we've been characterized as only caring about the baby and not caring about the mother, this is an unjust canard. This is libel, because it's just not true. There are more crisis pregnancy centers in the country than there are abortion clinics. All right, we are lining up. I've given dozens of fundraisers. That was how I met my wife, for CPCs to raise money, and people are coming deep in their pockets in order to take care of women. Where is the other side? Where are the pro-choice organizations stepping up in compassion next to the woman who decides to carry to term, and they're going to help her with the burdens that she's facing? Where is it? They have nothing to say but kill that baby. That's our compassionate response. I know you have emotional needs. I know you have financial needs. We're not going to do anything for that. We're going to charge you $1,000 to kill the baby. That's our answer. Pardon me for getting emotional about this, but this is the way it lines out. And we're the ones who are being called non-compassionate? Really? We don't get a dime. Not a dime from saving a baby. All right? We come out of pocket, pro-lifers do, to save the baby and to save the mom. People have no idea who haven't countenance, who haven't trafficked in that world. It's been unbelievable. Every time I speak at a CPC banquet, I always get there the day before, and the earlier part of the day from the banquet, I go to the facility. I tour the facility. I look at every single thing they're doing to help the mothers, all the packets of diapers and bottles and blankets and all the thing that the women get, the way they teach them crafts and ways to, you know, manage their finances. They help them with life support. We are doing this. And so for somebody to say, well, you're just not sensitive, you're just not compassionate, open your eyes. You tell me how compassionate it is to say, you either kill this baby or we're not going to do a dad blasted thing for you. Really, that's the compassionate response? Please.
You know, Greg, this issue is really going to be in people's conversations over the next couple months because of the Supreme Court. So if any of you have questions about abortion that you're having trouble answering, please send those in. And I'm hoping that we'll be talking about this over the next couple months and helping you out.
So I have a follow-up question, though, and mm-hmm. that is, when somebody says, well, you're not compassionate for the woman, this is the question. What do you think pro-choicers should be doing to help women who decide to show compassion to women who decide to carry to term? There you go. That's hitting the nail on the head. What do you think pro-choicers should do to be compassionate to women who decide to carry to term? I guarantee you they don't have an answer, or they might just toss one out, but none of them are going to do it.
All right, Greg, let's take a question from Sam from Oz. Why do you think offending someone is seen as the, quote, greatest sin in the world's eyes? What is going on at the core that people are so deeply distressed by being offended? I always think, what's so wrong about being offended?
Yeah, this is very easy to answer. I gave a lecture on the problem of evil at a university in Topeka, Kansas. And the first one up to the microphone, as I recall, was an elderly gentleman, identified himself as a philosophy professor at the university where I was speaking. And I wanted to know, okay, what's good? And I said, have you here, professor? What's on your mind? And the first thing he said was, I'm offended. That's the first thing he said. Okay, now why would he say something like that? Because it is so easy to parry any view at all by making this victim appeal. I'm offended. That's all you have to say nowadays. It's not that the people are really offended. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. And even if they were, why does this matter? If I was in that professor's class and he gave me an argument regarding against God, and I said, Professor, I'm offended. First of all, would he care? No. Second, would he countenance such a response? Of course not. Having an offense means nothing with regards to the issue. It's a way of manipulating opposition. That is what I am convinced is the chiefest appeal. And people get away with it all the time. And so since they get away with it, it's very easy to say. I have never heard, although I'm sure it must have happened where a Christian said, I'm offended about something, but not as a matter of responding to a challenge, I'm offended, as if this counts. It's not conservatives who characteristically do this. It's the other side of the spectrum, because they know that this is what gets traction. How dare you not be nice to me? How dare you not? Or this is the claim. There's no lack of niceness in making a case itself. You could do it in a nice way or a non-nice way, but now if you have the wrong view, you are offensive with your view. By the way, this goes back to CRT a little bit, critical race theory. One detail of critical race theory is oppression by ideology. Oppression by ideology. Races are oppressed. What does that entail? It used to mean go to the back of the bus. You can't have the job. You don't get paid as much. You can't drink at this water fountain. That means it was a physical oppression to the individual. Now, critical race theory entails the idea that oppression is just ideas that you disagree with. It's oppression by ideology. So now, broadly speaking, if you think if you want to throw homosexuals in jail, that's oppression. Used to be. I mean, that's the way that was viewed. Still is, obviously. But now, if you think homosexuality is wrong, that's your idea. But you're not taking any action of any kind towards homosexuals or against them. Just the fact that you hold the idea is oppressing them. They're not free. Why not? Because you think they're wrong. Well, they're still free. No, but you're oppressing them with your ideology. I'm offended. There you go. See how that works? This is how the ideas are working right now, and the manipulation is working right now. That's why you can't even hold contrary views. And of course, that, and especially when it gets actionable, enforceable, that you have different views, that's thought crime stuff. And that requires a thought crime police, which is exactly what we have. More and more and more. It's already in place. It's just accelerating. And this whole thing about I'm offended is a way, I think, that soft totalitarianism is able to move forward. Not hard from the government top down, but soft, which is lateral, that people in society can force you to, they can silence you or they can shame you into being silent because you have the wrong views. And notice, by the way, I mentioned shame. Shame is anathema to the left and the culture, unless they're the ones who are doing the shaming, and they shame all the time. This is just another example of it.
I think a big part of this, Greg, goes back to the changing view that we have of human beings. It goes back to the ideas of expressive individualism, where people think that what it means to be human is their ability to express what's inside of themselves and to basically create themselves and to reveal what's inside of them. That's what it means to be human. So if that's at our core as human beings, if you have somebody disagree with you, I think they are actually experiencing it as an attack on their personhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of these things are playing in. So as you have everybody's understanding of what it means to be human changing, they expect people to affirm them, to affirm everything they say, because everything they say is who they are. If you deny who they are, then you are oppressing them and you are denying them mm-hmm. dignity. And you
right,
see
right.
These
goes back.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, you see these ideas playing out in all sorts of ways. I mean, we were just talking about abortion. Part of the reason why people don't accept the unborn as being full human beings is because they can't express themselves yet. They don't have that ability yet. And so therefore, they're not full human beings because that's how they define who is a valuable human mm-hmm. being. So if anyone goes and
says...
Well,
that's a great...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Let me cut. We have a lag in the sound here, and that's why I end up walking on you.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But
Greg.
I have a lot of things to say. Go ahead and finish. Well, basically, people are saying they have no interior life because they're not developed yet, so they have no life. They have biological life, but that isn't what counts. It's the interior life that self-identifies in a particular way. Now, this is back to radical relativism. All right. Well, it is not the nature of the world out there that matters. It's the nature of the world in here that matters. Okay. They don't have a world in here to create a subjective identity from which they connect with or that they lean on. And so we can't rob them of an identity they don't have. But when we're conscious, sentient creatures thinking about who we are, we have made decisions about ourselves, and the decisions that we make about ourselves inside, how we see ourselves, that is what's real. In other words, that is the defining reality, is the point I'm making. Of course, your feelings and your assessments, your self-assessments are real. But isn't it the case that we often make assessments that aren't true? Self-assessments? Think of an anorexic. That's a person making a self-assessment that is not true. And the self-assessment is dangerous. We don't consider the self-assessments ultimate in everything yet, although it's getting more and more like that. But there's still an obvious counterexample where there is an objective reality and there's a subjective reality. Generally speaking, it's expressive individualism. That's the pattern. It's what I believe for myself. The truth is not out there. It's not in my genitals. In the objective world, the truth is in my mind about my gender, for example. And so if I have a penis and I believe I'm a woman, I'm a woman. You know, the state of California is now arranging to have menstrual products in all bathrooms because men menstruate. I just read it yesterday. And they're doing all kinds of stuff like this. All right. But what matters? It does not matter. The male female is on the inside. It's not on the outside. So that means you can be a man and you can menstruate. And if men menstruate, we need to have menstrual products in the men's bathroom. Okay, this is how crazy it's become. But it's because of an abandonment of the objective world and a complete, an increasingly complete dependence on the subjective world being the locus of reality. All right, that's what's true. What's outside is not true. And what I've said in my writings earlier this year, in the January, February, March solid ground, called the primal heresy. I said one of two powers is going to rule. One of two things is going to rule humankind, either truth or power. Truth or power. And if the truth of the world, God's world, the way God made the world, and God's moral truth does not rule, there's only one thing left, and that is power. And in expressive individualism, God's truth doesn't matter. The external world doesn't matter. It's what's on the inside. And here's what they don't realize. That means only power rules. But guess what? The EI crowd has the power at the moment. Their ox is not being gored. Wait until the power thing shifts. And somebody else who doesn't believe in their personal stuff gets the power. Then they can do whatever they are able to do with the power they now have. That's the way it works. All right, when power is all that's left. And when you deny objective truth and make it all subjective, this gives the tool to the totalitarians who get to decide for themselves what's best for society. And since they have the power, they can enforce it. And that's where we're headed.
And on that note... Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Bird.
Have a nice day.
Thanks for sending in your questions. If you have a question, please send that in on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.